apparently almost unseen, in the company only of Attorney General Robert Kennedy, the president and closest advisor in his lifetime of the late president. She spent a short time there and again kissed the flag, apparently a farewell kiss that probably will last through history as the most famous and one of the most famous and poignant farewell kisses in all history. We'll continue with our coverage of today's and the weekend's tragic event in a very short time.
Stay tuned now for a special broadcast in tribute to the memory of our late President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, immediately following a 10-second pause for station identification.
This is WABC, AM and FM, New York.
November 22nd, in the year 1963, 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. The President was dead. A nation, the world, stunned. A great unnatural stillness spread across the land. Traffic snarled in the streets. People just stopped and stared. The President was dead. The President was dead. The week that ended in national grief began on an almost festive note. The president was off on a political tour, the kind he liked best. Beside him, the nation's popular first lady, back in the public eye after months of recuperation following the birth and death of her third child. The crowds were friendly and noisy wherever the couple went. On Monday, it was Florida, Tampa, and Miami. On Tuesday and Wednesday, it was back to the White House for routine business, meetings with legislative leaders and government officials. On Thursday, Mr. Kennedy cleared his desk early to take off early for a quick tour through Texas. First San Antonio, then Houston. The crowds went wild all along the route, and his mood matched the mood of the people who greeted him, smiling, waving, handshaking, savoring every minute of the pastime he loved best, the business of politicking. Thursday night, the president and Mrs. Kennedy flew to Fort Worth. The next morning, he was up early at a Democratic breakfast. At 10:35, the couple left Fort Worth for the short plane ride to Dallas. This, by tradition, was hostile country to the president. The crowds, not so friendly, not so warm. And this was one of the reasons for the trip. The president had his eye toward 1964 and the presidential elections. He needed votes. He needed to wipe out some of that hostility. So the famous Kennedy grin was more the wider, the wave a little heartier, the hand clasp just a little stronger. The 11-mile trip from the airport to downtown Dallas was made in an open car. The crowds along most of the route were thin for the most part, but enthusiastic. They were receptive to the handsome young president, and he in turn was in good spirits because of it. The time, a few seconds before 12:30. And that's when it happened. The motorcade was just approaching a triple underpass. Shots rang out. A split second of startled silence. A scream. Then total confusion. The president slumped forward in his seat, blood streaming from his head. Mrs. Kennedy beside him cried, "Oh, no," and cradled his head in her arms. Texas Governor John Connally, sitting beside her, also slumped in his seat, struck by a bullet in the chest. A mad drive to Parkland Hospital, hurried hands clutching at the president's body, placing him on a stretcher, wheeling him into an emergency ward. At 1 o'clock, he was pronounced dead. 1 p.m., Central Standard Time. It was a cold, sunny January day when the world first took note of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. The year was 1961. He stood on the steps of the Capitol building to take the oath as 35th President of the United States. Inauguration day for John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. the energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
While the president underscored that the decade of the 60s would offer this country unprecedented opportunities and new problems, he also said the 60s would, in a sense, see a continuation of the threads which have been woven through American history for generations.
For I have sworn before you and Almighty God the same solemn oath our forebears prescribed nearly a century and three quarters ago. The world is very different now, for man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. And yet the same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe. The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed.
The brief and eloquent inaugural address that introduced the new president to the nation and the world was a plea for a program to get the nation moving at home and to assure a peaceful world. Throughout the Kennedy administration, these themes were to be voiced again and again in State of the Union messages, in budget and economic messages, and in special messages to Congress advocating specific legislation. The new team quickly went into action, with the president calling the signals in and on every play. His associates found him remarkably informed on even minute details of the nation's business. They learned to have their information at their fingertips, for the new president liked to come to decisions speedily, but wanted a full review of the facts before acting. The job ahead was a staggering one. The new president's program, an ambitious one. In 1960, John F. Kennedy made no attempt to disguise the platform on which he ran as a bed of roses. And after his election, in the weeks before his inauguration, he repeated his warning to the American people that the decade of the 60s would be fraught with both domestic and international perils.
To all Americans, I say that the next 4 years are going to be difficult and challenging years for us all. The election may have been a close one, but I think that there is general agreement by all of our citizens that a supreme national effort will be needed in the years ahead to move this country safely through the 1960s. I ask your help in this effort, and I can assure you that every degree of mind and spirit that I possess will be devoted to the long-range interests of the United States and to the cause of freedom around the world.
One of the first of the new horizons along the new frontier, establishment of a Peace Corps, a voluntary organization of patriotic Americans who would infuse American know-how in the fields of education, of industry, agriculture, and science into the underdeveloped nations of the world. It was back on August 28, 1961, that President Kennedy said bon voyage to the first group of Peace Corps volunteers to complete their training and embark for foreign shores.
The fact that you've been willing to volunteer, that you've gone through very detailed, demanding tests, that you are willing to go to Ghana and Tanganyika and other countries as time goes on. Americans who are without great compensation, all of you with special skills, which could mean that if you stayed home, you could pursue your own private interest with a good deal of assurance of success. The fact that you're willing to do this for our country and in a larger sense, as the name suggests, for the cause of peace and understanding, I think should make all Americans proud and make them all appreciative.
The Peace Corps turned out to be one of his most successful programs. Congress backed it to the hilt. But it was another story with the president's controversial Medicare program. In 1962, the Senate rejected the bill by the narrow margin of 4 votes. But there would be another year and another Congress. During the 1962 congressional elections campaign, the president toured the nation, trying to help assure that the next Congress would be heavily Democratic.
On a bill to provide a minimum wage, of $1.25 an hour. That's $50 a week. 89% of the Republicans voted against it. $1.25 an hour, $50 a week, just as 90% of the Republicans in the 30s voted against 25 cents an hour. That's why I'm a Democrat.
As the year 1962 grew older, John Kennedy became a much more controversial figure on the home front. Domestic issues broadened the aura of controversy around him. One was the steel crisis. In April of 62, U.S. Steel announced it was raising prices $6 a ton. The move came just 5 days after the signing of the steel contract, termed by the president as non-inflationary. John Kennedy began to get angry immediately. His anger increased the next day as other big steel firms followed the line set by U.S. Steel. Mr. Kennedy held a news conference that afternoon, and the entire nation saw his anger. He ripped into steel management as the tiny handful of steel executives who showed utter contempt for 185 million Americans. He voiced fears of inflation and vowed an all-out fight to roll back price increases. Then the president and his advisors started a counterattack, and fears were voiced in many quarters about the awesome display of presidential power. By Friday morning of that week, the industry front began to crumble. Firm after firm backed down, and so did U.S. Steel. Hand in hand with the steel crisis, myriad problems concerning the national economy. The president's proposed solution, a tax cut. Many of the president's major addresses during the last year and a half of his life had to do with the need to bolster the nation's economy through a reduction in federal income taxes, a reduction for both individuals and businesses. At mid-December of 1962, he told the Economic Club of New York,
"I'm not talking about a quickie or a temporary tax cut, which would be more appropriate if a recession were imminent. Nor am I talking about giving the economy a mere shot in the arm to ease some temporary complaint. I do not underestimate the obstacles which the Congress will face in enacting such legislation. No one will be satisfied. Everyone will have his own approach, his own bill, his own reductions. A high order of restraint and determination will be required, if the possible, is not to wait on the perfect."
And then a presidential appeal for Congress to act on tax cut legislation while it could still be of use to the economy.
"First, it should reduce the net taxes by sufficiently early date and a sufficiently large amount to do the job required. Early action could give us extra leverage, added results, and important insurance against recession. Too large a tax cut, of course, could result in inflation and insufficient future revenues. But the greater danger is a tax cut too little or too late to be effective. This nation can afford to reduce taxes. We can afford a temporary deficit, but we cannot afford to do nothing. For on the strength of our free economy rests the hope of all free nations. We shall not fail that hope, for free men and free nations must prosper, and they must prevail." Thank you.
But the president was to die before enactment of his tax cut proposals. When Mr. Kennedy made his fateful trip to Dallas, November 22nd, the tax bill had cleared the lower house, but still faced an uncertain fate in the Senate. Throughout the steel crisis and throughout his long fight for a tax cut, many of the president's critics accused him of attempting to gain power over industry, labor, and the economy in general. But the president repeatedly denied that it was his intention to control the nation's economy. In May of 1962, he told a union convention,
"This administration has not undertaken and will not undertake to fix prices and wages in this economy. We have no intention of intervening in every labor dispute. We are neither able nor willing to substitute our judgment for the judgment of those who sit at the local bargaining tables across the country. We can suggest guidelines for the economy, but we cannot fix a single pattern for every plant and every industry. We can and must, under the responsibilities given to us by the Constitution and by statute and by necessity, point out the national interest, and where applicable, we can and must and will enforce the law on restraints of trade and national emergencies. But we possess and seek no powers of compulsion and must rely primarily on the voluntary efforts of labor and management to make sure that their sense of public responsibility, their recognition of this dangerous and hazardous world full of challenge and opportunity, that in this kind of a world fulfilling our role, that the national interest is preserved."
If the American people were somewhat skeptical about the president's leadership abilities when he first assumed office, there was as much or more skepticism in the capitals of our European allies, and perhaps in the Kremlin, too. Nikita Khrushchev had tested Mr. Kennedy in Berlin. The president stood firm. But Khrushchev apparently felt that the results of that showdown were not conclusive. And so, in 1962, he secretly shipped nuclear-capable missiles to Castro, Cuba, and sent Soviet technicians and troops along to construct firing pads. Perhaps with the threat of nuclear devastation poised only 90 miles from American soil, the young president would be easier to deal with. But when U.S. intelligence detected the presence of the Russian missiles, Mr. Kennedy's response again was firm. He said further shipments of Soviet offensive weapons to Cuba would be blocked.
"A strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, where they're found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back."
But what if the missiles already in place on Cuba were launched at the United States?
"It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union."
With his intentions plainly proclaimed for all the world to hear, the president explained to this nation,
"My fellow citizens, let no one doubt that this is a difficult and dangerous effort on which we have set out. No one can foresee precisely what course it will take or what costs or casualties will be incurred. Many months of sacrifice and self-discipline lie ahead, months in which both our patience and our will will be tested, months in which many threats and denunciations will keep us aware of our dangers. But the greatest danger of all would be to do nothing."
President Kennedy had to make his toughest and most critical decision since entering the White House. Russia had a nuclear gun pointed, visibly pointed, at the heart of America. John Kennedy had to act. The very security of the United States was in danger. The world was in its gravest crisis since the Korean War. The problem of Cuba, which had haunted his administration, now demanded action. This was no Bay of Pigs fiasco. This was not fist-shaking tirades of Fidel Castro. This was a major Kremlin move on the Cold War checkerboard. There were Russian missiles and jet bombers in Cuba with the range and power to strike American cities. The firm stand by President Kennedy forced Premier Khrushchev to promise that his missiles would be withdrawn from Cuba. This, to the extent that U.S. intelligence techniques can assure us, was done. But a sizable Soviet military garrison remained on the island. A month after the worst of the Cuban crisis had passed, the Russian troops were still there, and newsmen questioned the president about the danger they posed.
As long as it's a Soviet military base, it, of course, it represents a threat to peace in the Caribbean. On the other hand, it does not represent an offensive threat under present conditions, nor will it be, of course, permitted to do so.
And then the president spelled out future U.S. policy to maintain a free and democratic society.
Less than a month ago, this nation reminded the world that it possessed both the will and the weapons to meet any threat to the security of free men. The gains we have made will not be given up, and the course that we have pursued will not be abandoned.
As quickly as it began, it was over, or so it seemed. Khrushchev had backed down, the U.S. had come out on top, and the Kennedy administration was at the height of its prestige. Shortly before the Cuban crisis came one of the biggest domestic crises. The issue, integration of the University of Mississippi at Oxford. An issue that involved presidential power, federal rights versus states' rights, and domestic politics. Segregation forces in Mississippi sought to block the enrollment of Negro student James Meredith at the all-white university, despite court orders which authorized his admission. State authorities were unable to lower the racial barriers. Federal intervention was necessary. By presidential proclamation, the Mississippi National Guard was placed under federal control, and Meredith proceeded to enroll without further intervention. That night, October 2nd, the president explained his actions to the nation.
Mr. James Meredith is now in residence on the campus of the University of Mississippi. This has been accomplished thus far without the use of National Guard or other troops. And it is to be hoped that the law enforcement officers of the state of Mississippi and the federal marshals will continue to be sufficient in the future. All students, members of the faculty, and public officials in both Mississippi and the nation will be able, it is hoped, to return to their normal activities with full confidence in the integrity of American law. This is as it should be, for our nation is founded on the principle that observance of the law is the eternal safeguard of liberty, and defiance of the law is the surest road to tyranny. The law which we obey includes the final rulings of the courts, as well as the enactment of our legislative bodies. Even among law-abiding men, few laws are universally loved, but they are uniformly respected and not resisted. Americans are free, in short, to disagree with the law, but not to disobey it. For in a government of laws and not of men, no man, however prominent or powerful, and no mob, however unruly or boisterous, is entitled to defy a court of law. If this country should ever reach the point where any man or group of men, by force or threat of force, could long deny the commands of our court and our Constitution, then no law would stand free from doubt. No judge would be sure of his writ, and no citizen would be safe from his neighbors.
James Meredith stayed on at Ole Miss, stayed on and then graduated from the university. But the president's involvement with problems of school integration, indeed with the overall Negro revolution for rights, was far from ended. His far-reaching proposals for civil rights legislation have caused a continuing storm on Capitol Hill and throughout the nation. But John F. Kennedy was not fated to see what direction that storm would ultimately take. From the time he took office, John Kennedy was involved in almost every major development at home and abroad. The Cuban crisis, Mississippi integration, U.S. elections, the steel crisis, the economy, the new trade program. The world seemed to spin from crisis to crisis. Almost each new dawn cast light on a new trouble spot, a new controversy, a new problem to be met and solved. There were moments of great joy for American accomplishments, moments of sadness and anger for failures, moments of chilling fear. It seems appropriate to turn back to that cold January day in 1961, when the youngest man ever elected to the presidency stood in front of the Capitol and spoke these words. In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. The president's determination that neither he nor the nation would shirk its responsibilities was put to the test in the city of Berlin. Berlin, once the proud capital of a united Germany, now an isolated enclave deep in the territory of communist East Germany. For years, East German puppets had been mimicking a voice from the Kremlin, a voice that called for a solution to the German question. What Khrushchev wanted was an end to military occupation, at least Western military occupation of German soil. He wanted the much-delayed German peace treaty. Perhaps most of all, he wanted to eliminate the Western foothold in Berlin. And in mid-1961, he had a stark, ugly wall erected to isolate the Western zones from East Berlin. President Kennedy met the challenge, met it with actions the Kremlin leaders could not mistake, prompt reinforcement of American garrisons in West Berlin and in West Germany. The question then became, would Khrushchev push the matter further? He wisely chose not to do so. While the attention and fears of the world were focused on Berlin, President Kennedy pointed out that the real source of all the trouble lay far to the east.
The world is not deceived by the communist attempt to label Berlin as a hotbed of war. The source of world trouble and tension is Moscow, not Berlin. And if war begins, it will have begun in Moscow and not Berlin.
In June of this year, almost 2 years after the communists constructed the ugly wall which still divides Berlin, the president himself visited the city. The 2 million inhabitants of West Berlin turned the visit into one of Mr. Kennedy's greatest personal triumphs. 250,000 of them gathered outside the West Berlin City Hall and heard the president say,
"There are many people in the world who really don't understand, or say they don't, what is the great issue between the free world and the communist world. Let them come to Berlin." Wenn es in der Welt Menschen geben sollte, die nicht verstehen oder nicht zu verstehen vorgeben, worum es heute in der Auseinandersetzung zwischen der freien Welt und dem Kommunismus geht, dann können wir Ihnen nur sagen, Sie sollen nach Berlin kommen. There are some who say that communism is the wave of the future. Let them come to Berlin.
Living with the communist wall had been hard. Hard for the president, hard for the Western Alliance, and perhaps hardest of all for the people of West Berlin. These words from Mr. Kennedy won the hearts of the isolated Berliners.
2,000 years ago, the proudest post was Kiewit Romanus Sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner.
If Mr. Kennedy won the hearts of West Berliners, he did little to soften the hearts of the communists. The Berlin problem was a recurring one, cropping up into the news seemingly every other week. But if President Kennedy was not completely successful in solving the question of Berlin, he was successful in achieving what he called the first step toward peace. We now pause 10 seconds for station identification. WABC, AM and FM, New York. The nuclear test ban treaty was the rather unexpected culmination of long months of unfruitful East-West dialogues at the Geneva disarmament meetings. Soviet moves throughout that long period had been unpredictable. Once the Russians announced a unilateral suspension of their own test explosions. But in 1961, without warning, the Russians broke their own test ban. Would President Kennedy run the risk that the Soviet tests would yield technological breakthroughs that might erase the U.S. leads in nuclear weapons?
Could such tests be deemed necessary to maintain our responsibilities for free world security in the light of our evaluation of Soviet tests, they will be undertaken only to the degree that the orderly and essential scientific development of new weapons has reached a point where effective progress is not possible without such tests.
But as things turned out, it was only the dark before the dawn. After years of what seemed to be fruitless negotiations, the great powers agreed on a partial nuclear test ban treaty. In Moscow, delegates from the United States, Great Britain, and Russia initialed a treaty prohibiting all but underground testing. Ratification of the accord by the rubber-stamped Soviet parliament was a foregone conclusion. But in the United States, the advice and consent of the Senate was needed. Some senators favored ratification. Others said they would vote no. Still others were on the fence. On the night of July 26th, President Kennedy went on nationwide radio and television and took his case for ratification to the final arbiters of congressional action, the American people.
I speak to you tonight in a spirit of hope. 18 years ago, the advent of nuclear weapons changed the course of the world, as well as the war. Since that time, all mankind has been struggling to escape from the darkening prospect of mass destruction on Earth. In an age when both sides have come to possess enough nuclear power to destroy the human race several times over, the world of communism and the world of free choice have been caught up in a vicious circle of conflicting ideology and interest. Each increase of tension has produced an increase of arms. Each increase of arms has produced an increase of tension. In these years, the United States and the Soviet Union have frequently communicated suspicion and warnings to each other, but very rarely hope. Our representatives have met at the summit and at the brink. They have met in Washington and in Moscow, in Geneva, and at the United Nations. But too often these meetings have produced only darkness, discord, or disillusion. Yesterday, a shaft of light cut into the darkness. Negotiations were concluded in Moscow on a treaty to ban all nuclear tests in the atmosphere, in outer space, and underwater. For the first time, an agreement has been reached on bringing the forces of nuclear destruction under international control, a goal first sought in 1946 when Bernard Baruch presented a comprehensive control plan to the United Nations.
If that first step nuclear test ban treaty was one of the president's major successes, his alliance for progress to his critics was one of his major failures. The program to help Latin nations help themselves got underway shortly after the president's inauguration. Speaking to an assembly of Latin envoys in Washington on March 13, 1961, President Kennedy laid down the principles of the alliance.
I have called on all people of the hemisphere to join in a new alliance for progress, Alianza Para Progresa, a vast cooperative effort, unparalleled in magnitude and nobility of purpose, to satisfy the basic needs of the American people. First, I propose that the American republics begin on a vast new 10-year plan for the Americas, a plan to transform the 1960s into an historic decade of democratic progress.
One thing the president insisted upon in his concept of the Alliance for Progress, it was not to be an alliance for handouts. The United States, he said, would help those who help themselves. The medieval, almost feudal social and economic structures in many Latin nations would have to be changed, not to satisfy a whim of the United States, but to prevent a radical, revolutionary shift toward communism. This, to the president, was the concept of the alliance. But despite his pleas made almost up until the minute of his death, the Alliance for Progress remained at best on shaky ground. Some of his closest advisors said that President Kennedy was at his best when grappling with problems of the most complex nature. But even a man of the president's great energies had to back off once in a while to restore both body and spirit. Summer vacations were often spent at Hyannisport, Massachusetts, winter holidays at Palm Beach, Florida. And there were visits to New York City, where Mr. Kennedy usually combined business with pleasure. On December 14, 1962, he took part in groundbreaking ceremonies for the 1964 World's Fair.
This is going to be a chance for us in 1964 to show the people from all over the world what kind of a people we are, what kind of a country we have, what the land is like, and what we've done with the land, what our people are like, and what we've done with our people, and what's going in the past, and what's coming in the future. That's what a World Fair should be about. And the theme of this World Fair, peace through understanding, is most appropriate in these years of the 60s.
A few days later, the president took part in another ceremony, the annual pomp and circumstance of lighting the Christmas tree in the nation's capital. A spirited and festive occasion. As Mr. Kennedy pressed the button which illuminated the thousands of lights on the tree, no one could foresee that this would be the last Christmas John Fitzgerald Kennedy would see.
This has been a year of peril when the peace has been sorely threatened. But it has been a year when peril was faced and when reason ruled. As a result, the hopes of the American people are perhaps a little higher. We have much yet to do. We still need to ask that God bless everyone.
For John F. Kennedy, the last Christmas. One of the president's most ambitious projects had been to overcome the Soviet Union's lead in space exploration, to make the United States second to none in space. To do this, he said, he was prepared to go to the moon.
Why some say the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Spurred on by the president, the U.S. space program made rapid strides. So that last Thursday, Mr. Kennedy could tell an audience at the Missile Center City of Houston,
next month,
when the United States of America fires the largest booster in the history of the world into space for the first time, giving us the lead, fires the largest payload into space, giving us the lead. It will be the largest payroll, too. And who should know that better than Houston?
On Thursday, the 21st, the day before his last, the president made that fateful journey into Texas. There he addressed a huge crowd that came to greet him. He told the story of the little boy who threw his hat over the wall and then had no choice but to climb the wall and get it. He went on to say,
"This nation has tossed its cap over the wall of space, and we have no choice but to follow it. Whatever the difficulties, they will be overcome. Whatever the hazards, they must be guarded against. With the vital help of this aerospace medical center, with the help of all those who labor in the space endeavor, with the help and support of all Americans, we will climb this wall with safety and with speed, and we shall then explore the wonders on the other side."
The next stop, Fort Worth. Again, thousands lined the route to see and cheer the Kennedys as they rode from the airport. Many of the onlookers stood waiting for hours.
I got up at 5 o'clock, first time I set the alarm in years. The most important thing is to see the president, then to see Mrs. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think she's lovely, but I think our president does come first.
I see.
She's a lovely person.
But I waked up at 2:30 and couldn't go back to sleep, so this is a rough day.
The next day would be rougher. The president and Mrs. Kennedy spent the night in Fort Worth. The next morning, Friday, Mr. Kennedy rose early to attend a Democratic Party breakfast. Mrs. Kennedy remained behind.
2 years ago, I said that introduced myself in Paris by saying that I was the man who had accompanied Mrs. Kennedy to Paris. I'm getting that same sensation as I travel around Texas. Nobody wonders what Lyndon and I wear.
The recurrent theme, "Ask what you can do for your country," was heard again in San Antonio on November 21st as the president urged the nation to face up to the responsibilities fate had thrust upon it.
Whatever the difficulties, they will be overcome. Whatever the hazards, they must be guarded against. I think the United States should be a leader. A country as rich and powerful as this, which bears so many burdens and responsibilities, which has so many opportunities, should be second to none.
On what was to be the final day of his life, the president took time to defend his administration's decision to have the TFX fighter plane developed and manufactured by the General Dynamics Corporation, despite the Boeing company's offer to produce the supersonic plane at a lower cost. The president asked his Fort Worth audience to look beyond the present contract award dispute to the undisputed value TFX would have as a weapon in the U.S. deterrent arsenal. Thousands of the planes will be assigned to the Air Force, and with slight modifications, the TFX will increase the strike power of the Navy, too.
The same basic plane will serve the Navy's carriers, saving the taxpayers at least $1 billion in cost if they built separate planes for the Navy and the Air Force. The government of Australia, by purchasing $125 million of TFX planes before they are even off the drawing board, has already testified to the merit of this plane.
After that Friday morning speech in Fort Worth, the president and his wife flew on to Dallas. They arrived there at 11:37 a.m. A long motorcade bore the presidential party from the airport into downtown Dallas. There, John F. Kennedy met his fate.
"And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country."
And now he is gone. What of the man who shot the president? He too was shot. On Sunday the 24th, as the president's body was being borne down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol building, the assassin was cut down by an assassin. And a short while later, as the president's body was lifted into place beneath the Capitol rotunda, the assassin died. Grim irony. One man lay beneath the flag of his country, enveloped in the love and sorrow of the world. The other lay beneath a coarse white sheet, enveloped in universal scorn. And so he is gone, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Some men are born great. Others have greatness thrust upon them. John Kennedy, his was a measure of greatness that historians in some future day will have to decide. He's too close to us now. Many words have been written and said about this man. Many more will be said and written in the days and years to come. But perhaps the words that'll be remembered most are the ones he himself spoke on a cold, wintry day in January 1961. "Ask not what your country can do for you," he said. "Ask what you can do for your country." And now he is gone. This is the ABC Radio Network.
The ABC Radio Network resumes its continuing coverage of the events surrounding the death and funeral of President John F. Kennedy in 10 seconds following station identification.
This is WABC, AM and FM New York. Time 5 minutes past one.
This is Bill Butel with Bill Brophy in the ABC Radio newsroom in New York. The seemingly impenetrable and all-embracing sadness and grief caused by the assassination of President Kennedy on Friday has not seemed to diminish in any way with the passing of the hours. If anything, it seems to grow deeper and deeper among nearly everybody that we reporters who cover this story run into, and certainly among us reporters ourselves. But our grief, of course, is nothing compared to the truly incalculable grief of Mrs. John Kennedy, the president's widow. Mrs. Kennedy went back tonight to the rotunda of the Capitol for one more glimpse of the flag-draped casket which holds the body of her husband, the assassinated president. Shortly after 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, Mrs. Kennedy walked unannounced, unexpected, through the crowds of mourners who had gathered outside the Capitol. She was holding to the arm of the slain president's brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. The mourners were still streaming past the casket in a steady stream. They were filling both sides of all sides of the rotunda of the Capitol. The Attorney General stopped at the rope which was holding back the crowd, a velvet rope, and Mrs. Kennedy walked slowly ahead. She continued to walk to the side of the casket. She knelt beside it, as she had earlier today with her daughter Caroline. This time she was alone. She placed her hand on the flag that draped the casket, and leaning forward, once again she kissed the casket. Mrs. Kennedy then stood. She turned her face, which of course was stained with tears, to the crowd, which had come to a halt on seeing her approach the casket. For a very long moment, she looked at the people coming to pay their respects to her husband. She, in the words of one reporter who was there, appeared to be looking each one of them straight in the face. And then the former First Lady walked back to her brother-in-law, Attorney General Kennedy, and left by the front door of the Capitol building. On her way out, Mrs. Kennedy had to pass by the throng of well-wishers who were coming into the rotunda, and as I say, as she did so, she appeared to look at each one full in the face. And even as Mrs. Kennedy filed out into the night, thousands of people who were lined up in Washington, block after block, waiting for their turn to look at the bier of the slain president, waiting patiently for an opportunity to pass by the casket, watched Mrs. Kennedy as she left the rotunda. At 8:30 p.m., officers doubled the pace by permitting viewers to go two abreast on either side of the bier. This, of course, was half an hour before Mrs. Kennedy came back to the rotunda. And at that time, the line reportedly was stretching 26 blocks from the Capitol building. Persons who finally were able to reach the rotunda and go in to view the casket said they'd been in line waiting for this opportunity for as long as 6 and 7 hours. 7,200 persons, it's estimated, had been going by the flag-draped casket every hour. Some elements or members of the Kennedy family were unable to get to the private viewing of the casket in the rotunda earlier this morning, notably Edward Kennedy, Senator Edward Ted Kennedy, and Mrs. Rose Kennedy, the father, or rather the mother of the late president, who were at the family home in Cape Cod in Hyannisport. Mrs. Kennedy and Ted Kennedy did get down to Washington and visited the rotunda later today, and they knelt beside the casket and they offered a brief prayer. The father of the assassinated president, Joseph P. Kennedy, the former ambassador to Great Britain, the man who dreamed for so long and put so much effort and hope into the life and work of his son, and who learned of his son's death only yesterday afternoon, will not be able to make it to the funeral tomorrow. Assumedly, this is because of the stroke which he suffered 2 years ago and from which he has never fully recovered. There's been no specific news on his condition, but it might well be assumed that because his recovery has not been complete, the family felt it inadvisable for him to make as strenuous a trip, strenuous physically, and, of course, more important, emotionally, to Washington for the funeral of his son. Incidentally, the rotunda of the Capitol will be open for as long as anybody wants to come and look at the bier of President Kennedy, and that may be well into the dark and early hours of this morning. History, of course, was made all through the past 60-odd hours since the, and it has been just about 60 hours since President Kennedy was shot in Dallas, Texas, and these have been history-filled days. The pictures and words of today probably will go down in history as some of the most important, most moving, most poignant words and pictures in the history of this country. One of those historic and eminently, profoundly moving scenes took place today in Washington. ABC's Bill Downs was on hand, and he describes that.
Thousands of people
Page is turning past the Treasury building up toward the Capitol, which is gleaming in the bright afternoon sunshine like a large confection, a cake. It's a beautiful sight. Too beautiful to be so solemn and sad. And as if symbolic of the youthful spirit of the president who was assassinated in Dallas 2 days ago, the horse, symbolic of his fallen leadership, likes this fall weather, and he's frisking, walking sideways, giving the sergeant who's leading this spirited black animal, giving him a lot of trouble. But the crowd has been very quiet, very attentive. It's as if Washington and the nation have been withholding their grief, as if it's unbelievable. I think we've all felt that. As if we're waiting for something to make us weep, because he was too young to die, let's face it. But he is dead, the 35th president of the United States. We have another. Washington is trying to get used to saying President Lyndon Johnson. President Lyndon Johnson. Now, the family, the military units, honor guards are now strung along Pennsylvania Avenue. They will go down from 15th Street to 4th and Constitution, and then up Constitution, up Capitol Hill, turn right at Delaware Avenue, and then to the Capitol Plaza. The parade is continuing down, now approaching Constitution Avenue, past the old post office building and the Raleigh Hotel, that's at 12th and Pennsylvania, and the Raleigh Hotel, where so many notables have stayed over the years, has now been consigned to the junk heap. It's going to be torn down and a new building built.
Bill Downs.
We have another report from the Capitol of what's going on there, standing by. But, Don, do you have something later?
A point of interest. All of Washington seems to have turned out for this sad duty today to pay their respects to Washington, to President Kennedy. They're lining Pennsylvania Avenue, Constitution Avenue, so many deep, as you've described. I wonder if you have any information of large numbers of people coming from out of town to Washington.
Yes, we've had people who've said they've come from far away as Chicago, Connecticut, up at the St. Matthew's Cathedral, from which the president will go to Arlington Cemetery tomorrow. There were people who came all the way from their homes just to attend Mass at that cathedral.
Bill, do you expect... Pardon me, Bill.
Nissan now is just passing the post office building, which recently was taken over by the U.S. Information Agency, now where mail used to be sorted for the Washington area. You have television pictures going out to all nations around the world. And again, the symbolic horse of the president, a black stallion, the saddle empty, of course, the stirrups hitched high. That horse is still fractious, still giving his leader trouble, still pawing the ground. The saber strapped to the saddle, bouncing at his side, as if saying I don't want to make this trip, but it's too beautiful a day.
Bill Downs, we've had some information that there's a possibility that the Capitol and the doors to the rotunda of the Capitol will be left open all night so the public can come in and pay their final respects to Mr. Kennedy. Can
that
you
is
confirm
correct.
That?
And we have John Ralston standing by and for a report on the ABC from the APC correspondent at the rotunda. Here is John Ralston.
The great plaza on the east side of the Capitol is being kept bare at this moment for the arrival of the cortege bearing the president's body. But just beyond the plaza, on the grass of the park, thousands of persons have gathered, waiting their turn to file through the rotunda and view the casket which bears the body of the president. Many of these people have been here all night. Many of them have come early this morning, 2 and 3 a.m. It was a cold morning, too. Now it is still cool, but the sun is shining brilliantly on the Capitol. The crowds, as they look across the bare plaza, face the steps where 2 years and 10 months ago, President Kennedy was inaugurated. It is up these steps that his body will be carried today into the Capitol Rotunda. Once the cortege arrives here, there will be an organization out on the plaza of the Honor Guard, which will carry the president's body up the steps. A 21-gun salute will be fired as the band plays Ruffles and Flourishes. Then it will play Hail to the Chief and begin a hymn. And as the hymn begins, the president's body will be lifted and carried up the steps on the east front of the Capitol. Preceding the body will be a special honor guard composed of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Assistant Chiefs of the Four Services and the Commandant and Assistant Commandant of the Coast Guard. They will lead the procession up the steps through a cordon of enlisted men and into the great rotunda of the Capitol, so familiar to so many visitors to Washington. The rotunda now is bare except in the center. The catafalque is prepared to receive the casket of the president. The catafalque, the wooden platform now covered with black velvet, which was built and first used for the assassinated President Lincoln. There will be a ceremony inside before the public is allowed to view the body. There will be here many members of Congress, members of the diplomatic corps, other high government officials, and of course, the president's family. And one addition has been made to the ceremony this morning. There will be brief speeches, 3 eulogies, delivered by the Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren, by the Democratic Leader of the Senate, Mike Mansfield, and by the Democratic Speaker of the House, John McCormick.
The funeral cortege of John Fitzgerald Kennedy described by ABC newsmen. After that point, the casket was taken off the caisson. The band played Hail to the Chief. As an honor guard, pallbearers, he carried the casket into the rotunda at a slow march. Very impressive, very moving. And then began a hymn that is familiar to most people, but as is often the case on a thing like this, I can't remember the name of it, and I've been trying to see if anybody can remember what that hymn was. Somebody knows somewhere, but it might have been lost in the rush of emotions today. The ABC newsman describing the cortege spoke about the ceremony that went on inside the Capitol after the body of the president was laid on the catafalque. And of course, the body was preceded by an honor guard, followed immediately by the presidential flag, which is the custom. The presidential flag will follow the casket through the entire ceremony tomorrow. And right behind the presidential flag was Mrs. Kennedy, John Jr., and Caroline. And that ceremony included the respects from family and dignitaries who had gathered inside the rotunda, and eulogies by
the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren, the Speaker of the House, John McCormick, and the Majority Leader of the Senate, Mike Mansfield, the Senator from Montana. And it was Mansfield's address that many observers have marked for immortality. And this is the way it sounded.
Kennedy, members of the Kennedy family, my fellow Americans, all. There was the sound of laughter, and in a moment, it was no more. And so, she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hands. There was a wit in a man, neither young nor old, but a wit full of an old man's wisdom and a child's wisdom. And then, in a moment, it was no more. And so she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hands. There was a man marked with the scars of his love of country, a body active with the surge of a life far from spent. And in a moment, it was no more. And so she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hands. There was a father with a little boy and a little girl, and the joy of each in the other, and in a moment, it was no more. And so she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hands. There was a husband who asked much and gave much. And out of the giving and the asking, wove with a woman what could not be broken in life, and in a moment, it was no more. And so, she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hands and kissed him and closed the lid of the coffin. A piece of each of us died at that moment. Yet in death, he gave of himself to us. He gave us of a good heart from which the laughter came. He gave us of a profound wit from which a great leadership emerged. He gave us of a kindness and a strength fused into the human courage to seek peace without fear. He gave us of his love that we, too, in turn, might give. He gave that we might give of ourselves, that we might give to one another, until there would be no room, no room at all, for the bigotry, the hatred, the prejudice, and the arrogance which converged in that moment of horror to strike him down. In leaving us these gifts, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, President of the United States, leaves with us. Will we take them, Mr. President? Will we have now the sense and the responsibility and the courage to take them? I pray to God that we shall, and under God, we will.
Senator Mike Mansfield of Montana, the Senate Majority Leader, with his eulogy to President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. I'm informed from Washington that the line outside the Capitol Rotunda is now 22 blocks long. That many people are wanting to get in to view the casket holding the body of the late president. It is unfortunately rather improbable that in the 8 hours, or rather 7.5 hours, before 9 a.m., that these all these people will be able to get into the rotunda. I say 9 a.m. because that's the time that the people within the rotunda must make preparations for the beginning of the procession and the funeral tomorrow. Now, those people in 22 blocks are lined five abreast. I would have no idea how many people that represents, but 22 blocks of people five abreast is a great many people, to be sure. Bill?
It was said earlier this evening, Bill, that some 7,200 people had viewed the body of the president, and I'm sure at this time many, many more thousands have been added to that figure. It has also been said that never before in the history of the world have so many world leaders converged on a single place in a given city for any reason whatever, to do homage to a man or for any other reason. And French President Charles de Gaulle and Prince Philip of Britain today led this procession of national leaders from all over the world to mourn at the grave of our late President Kennedy. By the eve of President Kennedy's funeral, the highest elected officials of the three major European allies, Britain, France, and West Germany, had arrived in Washington. They were the vanguard of delegations from more than 50 nations who will march behind President Kennedy's coffin in Monday's final rite. And from behind the Iron Curtain, Soviet First Deputy Premier Anastas Mikoyan, Premier Nikita S. Khrushchev's personal representative, was flying here from Moscow, but would not arrive until Monday morning. Neither de Gaulle nor West German Chancellor Ludwig Erhard, nor Philip, husband of Queen Elizabeth II, nor British Prime Minister Sir Alec Douglas Hume, had words for the public when their planes were met at the airport by Secretary of State Dean Rusk. They moved quickly, solemnly, through the reception line of U.S. officials and ambassadors from other nations, and then sped into the capital to await the funeral tomorrow. President de Gaulle, the austere French leader whose policies conflicted so often with the late President Kennedy's, without diminishing his own respect for the younger American, had cabled in advance to the French embassy, "The time for mourning is not the time for making statements." The White House said President Johnson would be conferring with some of the international leaders Tuesday, although the list had not yet been released. De Gaulle, Earhart, and Hume almost certainly would be among those he would want to see. President Johnson also was to receive all the foreign delegation leaders at a State Department reception Monday afternoon. But first, they would meet Mrs. Kennedy at perhaps what will be the last White House reception she will ever hold. She will see all the foreign heads of state and delegation leaders at the White House immediately following the burial of her husband at Arlington National Cemetery. British Labour Party leader Harold Wilson, who could supplant Hume at the next election within less than a year, also is a member of the British delegation. And from across the seas, the president of a land that certainly had a special reason to love President Kennedy, Ireland's Eamon de Valera, arrived today at Idlewild's International Airport. ABC's microphones recorded his arrival.
President Eamon de Valera of Ireland has just landed here at Idlewild Airport on his Washington and the funeral of President Kennedy. His two sons are with him, as is the American ambassador to Ireland, Matthew McCloskey, and Frank Aiken, who is the Minister of External Affairs of the Republic of Ireland. Mayor Wagner has met him at the plane and has brought him to where our ABC microphones are set up, and newsmen are awaiting his statement.
When last I left the United States, I had little thought that my return should be under circumstances like these. Circumstances of deep grief for the people of the United States, and scarcely less grief for the people of Ireland. From the moment of his nomination, our interest, people took a keen interest in President Kennedy. He was of our race, of the blood of the noblest of our Gaelic and Norman stock. When he became president, we watched him closely, anxious that he should bear himself well in the great position of power and responsibility which he held. He was not found wanting. And when he returned, when he came on a visit to Ireland, people flocked to greet him and to show their regard for him. They watched him closely as he passed amongst them and on television. And the more they saw of him, the more they liked him, and the greater grew their affectionate admiration for him. So when the terrible news of his death came over, in every household in Ireland, practically, it was felt not merely that the world had lost a great leader, but that they themselves had lost a close friend. As President de Gaulle has said, he died as a soldier in action, doing his duty in the service of his country. In all ages, such a death has been accounted as of the noblest. But it does not fill the void in the hearts of his family, members of his family, and the hearts of his countrymen. It is a compensation that he died so. Our hope must be that the bright example which he set of prudent statesmanship and steadfast courage will inspire and be followed by all who hold the destinies of peoples in their hands. Vlahaste Grevshe.
Statement by President de Valera of Ireland. Incidentally, on the plane with President de Valera are 24 cadets from the Irish Army Military College. During his visit to Ireland last June, President Kennedy placed a wreath on the graves of the Irish revolutionary leaders at Arbor Hill in Dublin, which is the National Cemetery of Ireland. And at that time, these cadets performed, and the president was so impressed that he spoke of it many times after his return. As a result, the Kennedy family has requested that these cadets be flown over from Ireland to form a guard of honor at the funeral services tomorrow. President De Valero and his party are going on to Washington tonight. This is Charles Osgood, Idle Wild Airport.
A report from Charles Osgood on the arrival of the President of Ireland at Idlewild's International Airport, with remarks from Mr. Eamon de Valera himself. West Berlin's highest elected official, Mayor Willy Brandt, is in Washington preparing for tomorrow's presidential funeral. Upon his arrival this evening, Mayor Brandt offered these views on what has happened and what can be expected.
This moment of America's tragic loss, my people know that they too have lost a great man and a great friend. And just as President Kennedy has always stood by our side, ready to give the city of Berlin and the people of Germany courage and strength in times of crisis and need, I now bring with me to Washington our assurance that we stand together with the United States and its people in their time of grief. And I think I should add this: the death of President Kennedy should not divide the free world, but should bring us all closer together so we could keep alive those ideals President Kennedy stood for.
Mayor, you know the new president, Lyndon Johnson?
Yes.
And have you met him before? And
yes.
What is your impression of him, sir?
I think this is not the time to go into any details. I am absolutely convinced that President Johnson will follow up the policy of close cooperation, and we put great confidence in President Johnson.
Thanks so much.
West Berlin's Mayor Willy Brandt with his remarks on arrival in this country to attend President Kennedy's funeral.
As if the assassination of President Kennedy and the ensuing events following that particular